Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from The Grave Talks. Coming up in several weeks, we're going to be playing an awesome interview I just did with the grandson of Ed and Lorraine Warren, Christopher Edward McKinnell. In it, we talk about everything from Amityville to The Conjuring to Annabelle to what it was like, personal stories growing up as the grandson of one of the most famous paranormal investigative teams in history. It's a really intimate look at that life with that amazing family. You can, of course, wait to hear it when it comes out in June, or I can send it to you right now in its entirety, part one and part two. But here's what I need from you so I can send you that email with that download link to that full hour-long episode. We are looking for more listeners to our program. People finding out that we even exist is sometimes of quite a feat. Apple Podcasts is where a majority of downloads to podcasts occur. You may or may not be aware of that, but that is where a lot of people find the show to begin with. So what I need from you is a review, basically. Go to Apple Podcasts and leave The Grave Talks a review, and then send me a screenshot. Let me know that you left that review. Send it to Tony@realghoststoriesonline.com. And when you do that, I will reply back with a private link to that episode of the program months before it is released. You'll get the full thing, not just part one. You'll get part one and part two as a thank you. This is a limited offer. It's only going to stand till about the end of May of 2019. If you want in on getting this episode way in advance, just do that review. I think you're going to love this episode, and your help in this process of letting folks know that we exist is tremendously helpful. You see, when you leave that review, it helps other people know that we exist who are interested in the same topic. So it really does good for the whole community out there who are searching for shows like this, who are brand new to the world of podcasting. So please leave that review. Go to Apple Podcasts. That's where this is really going to count. Even if you are not an Apple member or you don't use Apple Podcasts, you can create an account and leave a review. Do that. Send me the screenshot. I will get you the episode. So take a minute, 2 minutes to get it done. And boom, you're going to get this episode, part one and part two, in its entirety, full hour-long interview for free as a thank you for that gesture of support. My email again, Tony@realghoststoriesonline.com. That's where you send the proof. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for the support. Now on with today's episode. Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted Lincoln Theater. The haunted Lincoln Theater in Illinois has been the stage for some of the most iconic performers in history, Harry Houdini and more. Long after the stage shows ended, the Lincoln Theater fell onto hard times, suffering through multiple closures and reopenings. Through it all, did some of the performers never leave? Did the ghosts of some of history's top performers still grace the stage of the haunted Lincoln Theater? Some claim to have even seen and heard the ghost of Houdini himself, telling from the stage it was time for magic and a shocking EVP. Today, we discuss the haunted world of the Lincoln Theater and how the ghosts are captured with paranormal investigator Dale Kaczmarek.
Well, the theater obviously is located in downstate Decatur, Illinois, and it's truly one of the most haunted theaters that I've ever investigated. In the country. The theater was originally built back in 1916 by a guy named Clarence Waite. That's just like the W-A-I-T, Waite. And the building was actually built, this theater was built on the site of a tragic fire that took place here in 1915, which destroyed the Decatur Hotel, killing an unknown amount of people inside. So basically, the theater was right built upon the ashes of this very tragic fire. It opens for its first performance back October 26th of 1916 and has seating for over 1,200 people. One of the very first performances, the first performance actually was a comedy called Hit the Trail Holiday by George M. Cohan. It was later opened as the Lincoln Square Theater, but it was simply called the Lincoln Theater later on. When crowds began to dwindle, the theater was closed up for a time, and today, with the help of restoration, is once again open to the public. some of the actors that have been involved or have graced the stage include people like Ethel Barrymore, Jeanette MacDonald, Tallulah Bankhead, Al Jolson, Bob Hope, and even Harry Houdini. It was said that he performed on stage and used a trap door on the stage to simply disappear. So it was sort of an illusion. It wasn't really magic, I guess. I guess you could call it magic. And there's actually a trap door that you can actually see still, or the remnants of that trap door right in center stage. There are many different ghosts associated with the theater. Most often people see a lot of shadow figures and shadowy images throughout. One includes a man, or at least a ghost, that has been encountered near the stage called One Arm Red. Nobody knows his real name, but Red was apparently a stage hand back when this was a vaudeville. A lot of vaudeville plays were put on here. And one night he was working high above the stage in the metal grid work when he slipped and fell. He tried to catch himself, but hitting the stage many feet below by reaching out to stop his plummet, but his arm became snagged between two beams, and apparently his arm was tore out of his socket from the shoulder. He was allegedly found dead the next day. I think throughout the years, many people have heard eerie sounds, footsteps in the vacant theater, reports of whisperings and voices have been heard, as well as a strange figure often seen in the balcony from time to time. There's a very creepy spiral staircase that is off stage. It's a very circular metal spiral staircase. And we, during our investigations, I'll tell you right now, it's one thing I'm a little concerned about is heights. And it's a really kind of a weird height. It's very, very dark back there. There's a little tiny little area up there. I'm not really sure what it was quite used for. And we had put some cameras and digital recorders up there to let them run for a while. And we did get some whispers and so forth that we heard. Other reports include the sound of footsteps climbing up that spiral staircase in the back of the stage. It was reported to several people clearly while filming a television segment. As they were filming, they were walking up the staircase with somebody who was telling the history of the location. When they stopped, they heard somebody else walking up behind them. You could actually hear the clank of, footsteps coming back up behind them. Of course, they looked back down. They turned the flashlight on, and there was nobody walking on the stairs.
Let's before we keep going forward with more of the experiences, because I want to hear more of them, let's go back a little bit further to some of the history and some of the events that that took place. You had said earlier that the fire that occurred in 1915, there's an unknown number of deaths. Why is it that there was an unknown number? Was there just not a good record keeping of who was in the building at the time?
That could have been possibly one of the reasons, and because the fire was so devastating and literally burnt the building down, many people were burned beyond recognition, and maybe some of the bodies were incinerated to the point where they couldn't actually determine if this arm went with this body, sure, if his head went with this body. So there's not a lot of that was been able to kind of dig up in the past about that, but it is a tragedy that took place. And of course, any place time where you have untimely death, people that die tragically. There's been many other theater fires in Chicago, that the very famous, sure, Iroquois Theater fire that killed 620 people in that theater. Very often when you get things like that happen, there's always a chance of paranormal activity in the future.
Sure. When the theater was built over the site of that hotel, I would imagine, I mean, I'm sure it's hard to tell, we're basing everything and you know, thoughts on records, but it seems like a pretty quick turnaround of a tragedy and then boom, theater right up on the site of where all these people had perished. How far back does it go? What is the earliest report, I guess, of some sort of paranormal activity. Is there anything that traces back to the theater's first run after it was built?
I guess a lot of the reports began to stem, if my memory serves me correctly, back around the 1940s, 1950s, mm-hmm. Through the 60s. It didn't happen immediately afterwards, and even in the Iroquois Theater fire, the building was completely destroyed inside, but it wasn't burnt to the ground, and they just kind of, refurbished it. And they don't even tell the history of people when they go through the building anymore that there has been a tragedy here. But there usually is, and I've noticed this in fires, tragedies that I've kind of scoped out in my work, that there is usually a very quick turnaround in these locations where something happens, and in some cases they rebuild a new theater or something else, and sometimes they just simply scrap the area.
Now, with this building, was it completely rebuilt, or are there parts of the hotel that are part of the theater?
No, the building was completely demolished, okay. And the theater was built directly on that same property.
Okay. So as far as early reports of activity in the building, where does that trace back to? Is that more modern times as the theater's been refurbished and repurposed here again? Or does that go back even further to the time of it being abandoned or its previous life and activity in it?
Well, I mean, most of it started, within, say, 20, 30 years or so, maybe 40 years or so after the theater was built and opened up.
Okay.
It's more contemporary stories that seem to happen where people today are attending either a conference or there some other event there that they'll experience something. But a lot of the reports seem to happen to people when the building is kind of closed, when it's very quiet.
What is the?
There may be some stagehands cleaning up, and that's when they'll pick up a lot of these activity.
What is the oldest known account that you're aware of in some detail that you are aware of the building of having something paranormal happen in it?
Well, that would be the story I told about the One Arm Red.
Okay.
That basically is one of the oldest stories, and it's one that it continues to this very day. There have been reports of shadow figures. There have been reports of sounds on the stage, in some cases loud noises, which might be indicative of maybe somebody hitting the stage, falling from a distance or something. Of course, when people explore and try to figure out what's going on and what caused that sound, of course, there's nothing there.
Okay, tell me about the time when it was abandoned. How long was that for, and when did it get a new chance at life?
Well, again, the theater basically was built just about a year after the fire, and
I thought, didn't you say it was abandoned for a while?
Did I say that? I'm not sure.
You did. At the beginning of the interview, you said the theater, it was opened after the fire, and then it was kind of sitting abandoned for several years, and then it was reopened. That's where I'm getting to.
Right. There have been several instances in the history of this theater where it has been closed down for a while. In fact, in the time between the opening and then vaudeville, it was very, very big. And then after kind of vaudeville kind of panned out and it wasn't so popular, it was kind of converted into a regular movie theater where they would have movies and then maybe some plays on occasion, but not like the vaudeville. And then it was after that time period, this is probably going back to the 1940s or so, where it really kind of the interest kind of petered out in the movie house and so forth. And for a while at that point, this is when the theater became closed up and kind of abandoned, and it kind of fell into disrepair for a while. Of course, there was nobody fixing, maintaining stuff inside of there, and then eventually it kind of gave a new breath of life in more modern times.
Okay. So tell me about your investigations there. What drew you to the theater?
Well, obviously, theaters are one of the locations, besides hospitals, prisons, and state mental institutions, that we seem to get the most activity from. In my work, those are the four locations that are top priority. And, of course, theaters A lot of people come through theaters in the course of their lifetime and the lifetime of the theater. There's all different types of emotions that take place. And in some cases, there can be tragedies that take place inside theaters, as I pointed out. We've been investigating this theater far back as 2007, I think was one of the very first times we were there investigating. And what we do for our work, basically, is we'd already had known somewhat of the history of the place. I mean, I always like to try to dig up some more history whenever possible. But we set up a lot of specialized equipment, a lot of infrared cameras, a lot of digital recorders, MEL meters, different devices that pick up energy fluctuations, cold spots, and of course we snap a lot of digital infrared photographs throughout the course of our investigation. The very first time we investigated was October 27th of 2007. And we were there. At that point, we had a very nice piece of equipment that we called Geist. Of course, it's the German word for ghost in the term poltergeist. And it's really an acronym for Geophysically Equipped Instrument of Scientific Testing. And what it does, basically, it's a self-contained piece of ghost hunting gear. This device, when it's hooked up, you can hook up a lot of different parameters to it. You can hook up a tri-field meter. You can hook up a device that actually picks up smells, hydrogen sulfide, the smell of rotten eggs, which people often experience. It also pick up static fields or negative ions, like static electricity, cold spots, and all different fluctuations. It can be hooked up to a camera. So in other words, when one of these devices alerts that there's something going on, then instantaneously a picture will be snapped at that same time. It will be timestamped. So now we can go back, pull the files later, figure out, okay, this meter went off at this time. We snapped the picture, and maybe we got something, maybe we don't get something. So basically, this is the kind of device you can set into a room, set into an area, leave, come back an hour later, 2 hours later, and it basically does the work for you.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get a lot of stuff there. We did get some high EMF readings in the basement. Of course, we assumed some of that was due to some of the conduit and wiring and so forth that was down there. One of the most interesting things that happened to me, we had our sort of our command center in the lobby right below the mezzanine. And I went down to check the Geist and the monitors, because at that time we used to set up cameras, hot wire everything to a command center, and in real time be able to see what was going on. A little bit more than a DVR, each individual camera was hot wired to monitors and split screen. So I went back there to kind of check into the command center to see if anything had been picked up. And there was nobody upstairs. There was nobody directly above me in the mezzanine. I felt a pain on top of my head, and I go, wow, that hurt. And I'm looking around, and there was two people in the lobby, and I'm pointing up to the mezzanine. I said, is there anybody up there? They said, no, there's nobody up there at all. And I'm looking around, and sure enough, there was a dime on the floor that, lack of a better term, had suddenly materialized out of thin air or something. Hit me in the head and landed on the ground. It wasn't an old dime. It was a more modern dime. It was a Roosevelt dime. It would have been, I guess, more interesting if it had been a Mercury head dime or something, a silver dime from that time period. But I thought that was very unique. I mean, the first thing I thought that somebody was playing kind of a prank on me, had dropped something down on me. But there was nobody upstairs, and there was no place for this dime to materialize from.
That's a somewhat of a common thing for people to find coins in haunting situations. Are you familiar with that?
Absolutely.
What's the story behind it? Is there a meaning behind finding coins in a haunted situation?
It can be in some cases. We investigated a place, a private residence in Chicago, where a lady was apparently being haunted by her husband. And she would constantly find pennies all over her apartment. Now, at first she thought that maybe she had, they're in her bed or somewhere had stuck to her body, which is kind of a weird explanation for that. And maybe when she got up, they were falling off her body. But I mean, why would you have a bunch of pennies in your bed? It didn't really make any sense. And she was finding these all over the place. So, the idea of coins materializing You know, can sometimes be an indication of something strange is going on. It's not always something that we can find an explanation for or why that's happening, but it does happen.
It is very odd. It's almost like, is it an easily manipulatable object and that's why they drop them or move them? But the thing is, where are they coming from is the bigger question. Are they just materializing or are they finding them somewhere else that we're unaware of?
If you remember, if you go back to, and this is a movie now, but if you go back to the movie Ghost with Patrick Swayze, when he became a ghost and he was trying to communicate with his wife, there was other ghosts supposedly on the other side that was teaching him how to manipulate objects. And the very first object you remember he tried to manipulate was a penny. Mm-hmm. He took a penny with his finger and he was trying to exert his force on there and his whatever and his energy, and it finally moved that penny. So, I mean, there seems to be an indication that, you know, smaller objects like that can and sometimes be manipulated by spirits. I find it, however, it's usually most often when you have the movements of objects and things of that nature, that often tends to be more of a poltergeist nature.
Yeah.
And poltergeist, of course, with the German word meaning noisy ghost. We believe, and many researchers believe, I am among them, is that many times the poltergeist phenomena is not really caused by a ghost at all. It can be caused by a living agent, usually an adolescent going through puberty between the ages of, say, 13 to maybe 17, 18 years old, and most often female, that has very pent-up emotions within themselves. They kind of keep these bottle up within themselves, just like a battery that continues to charge up. Eventually they discharge in a kind of a paranormal way. I kind of call it kind of a mental temper tantrum, that you're wanting an object to move across, but you're not actually physically touching it, and it flies across the room. Of course, a good indication of this would be the movie Carrie with Sissy Spacek. She was thought that she had what was called telekinesis, the mind over matter, that you move these objects with the mind. And so many times when we're involved in cases where there is movements of objects, the first thing we look for, is there an adolescent in the proximity or in the building that fits that profile, that scenario, that might be causing that phenomenon? If not, then we sometimes look back and say it could be caused maybe by a spirit.
Sure. My house would be haunted as shit at this point. Yeah. Well, or it will be very soon, as I have one that's just entering into those teen years, and we're going to have Amityville going on soon, I have a feeling. it's an interesting thing with that, because obviously they're not the if it is the adolescent that's causing it, and I think a lot of us are familiar with that concept. You know, it's not like they're conscious of this. It's just energy being expelled, essentially, that seems to manipulate or play into the atmosphere, then it's causing these things to move about. Correct.
Yeah, or it could be, in the case, if you go back to the movie Ghost, it could be in a way that spirits are trying to show you that they're there.
Almost
by very subtle things that are happening.
Could something be feeding off of the energy of an adolescent, like a ghost itself? They're going, oh my God, there's this battery of a person. Could that then be used, do you think, from something out there to feed off of?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we are constantly being used, I mean, all the time in one way, shape, or another. When we investigate locations, very often some of our equipment may die. Fully charged batteries that have been put in there, they were charged overnight, or fresh batteries out of a pack. It could be in a digital recorder or another piece of equipment, suddenly are drained within a few minutes after arriving. It's like that spirit is saying, oh, here's an energy source here, mm-hmm. Whether it be a battery or a person, and it drains them to use that to manifest in some way, either through a visual apparition or through sights or sounds or smells or movements or cold spots. Sometimes in the course of investigations, this has happened to me, you know, dozens and dozens of times, and I'll feel myself like I'm drained, like I'm just like, ugh, like I'm weak, like mm-hmm. I'm out of energy. And I often wonder, is it the ghost that's there that's actually physically taking our energy, which is a measurable energy? Our energy can, in fact, be measured by scientific equipment, that we have a that lack of a better term, of bioenergy that's within ourselves that can be measured. And I think spirits can tap into that.
Yeah. And that's got to be an interesting thing, because sometimes, you know, I find myself just nothing paranormal, but just working around the house doing things. Sometimes I'll have all the energy in the world, and sometimes it'll just, you know, you'll just suddenly be drained, and you're not even really quite sure why that is. But and oftentimes that's just working around the house and being out of shape. But when you're in a situation like that, where you're investigating something and there's not a lot of energy being exerted, that's got to be confusing as to why am I suddenly feeling so drained. But that would certainly be a possible explanation for it. Let's go back to the theater for a little while more. Tell me more about the identities of the spirits that you believe are haunting this theater, if you can name any of them.
Well, I mean, yeah, I truly believe that we may have, you know, this is going to be, you know, shocking to some people, that we may have actually picked up the spirit of Harry Houdini there. At least during one EVP session we were doing back in June of 2009, we were there again doing an investigation of the theater, and we were doing we were down in the room directly below the Houdini trap door. So in theory, this would have been in his lifetime where he would have had an illusion on the stage and he said, okay, I'm going to disappear, and pops in a little trap door and he's gone. And it mystifies people. They can't figure out where he's at. Mm-hmm. Well, we're doing an EVP session right below that. And we had a very, very class A EVP that came through at the time. We had asked the question, what are you going to perform for us tonight? And we had a very strange sounding voice that came through that said, magic. And it was extremely loud. Nobody heard it, because if they would have heard it, I mean, if we would have heard it, we would have stopped immediately and said, where did that come from? If you play that EVP, which is actually on my website that people can actually go to under the Lincoln Theater investigation, they'll actually hear the question, the response, and immediately after that, we continue with another question. So we never heard that come through. I thought that was amazing. I think maybe Harry Houdini was hanging around or had dropped in for a visit in one of his many places that he was at during his lifetime. It was one of the strangest sounding kind of magic.
Yeah.
You know, very loud, class A, and nothing you can read into. It didn't come through an obelisk or a ghost box or anything like that. This is before the time we had any ghost boxes. I did have an obelisk with me, but it wasn't on at the time. So it was actually a true EVP that came through. We also, we had heard some, we had a static camera set up on the stage, basically just filming the whole time we were there, because this was an area where, as I mentioned before, supposedly one-armed Red fell from the rafters and was killed. They had heard footsteps and seen shadowy figures. So we were hoping to capture something on there. During a time that nobody was near the camera, and I always keep, and this is something I'm very diligent about, when I cut something out of a session that we do, I mean, I keep the entire session. So, I mean, I have, if you can see my files, of just stacks and stacks of audio tape and videotape. And I do this so I can show people that, you know, okay, we set up the camera, you hear us walk away, and then it's quiet and there's nothing here. And so it's just unedited. And all of a sudden, then you hear something in the middle of that. Nobody's approached or came nearby. We actually heard kind of a, initially what sounded like a kind of a disembodied breath, like a, you know, right near the camera. Of course, the camera is showing there's nobody there. There was no footsteps approaching, and it was suddenly gone. A little bit later, before that, we were down in the dressing rooms, down in the lower level of the theater, and we were doing an EVP session, and a question was asked, how many of you are here? And a whispery voice was heard in the background. We weren't able to quite make out what it was saying. Of course, we don't whisper during EVP sessions. You know, we tell our researchers and we tell everybody. In fact, people that, you know, like Ghost Hunting 101, the first thing you never do during an EVP session is you whisper. Mm-hmm. Because whispers can be misconstrued as an EVP later when you listen to them. And even if you move around, you cough, you burp, something like that, you always identify that. You tag your EVPs. And there was nothing tagged on that. It was just, the question was asked, and a whispery voice was heard in the background. So, you know, there were some instances where we saw a lot of stuff, and some cases we didn't. But probably the most interesting thing that happened to us during that investigation in 2009, we were snapping pictures throughout the building, sometimes using a digital infrared camera and sometimes using a regular digital camera with a flash. And one of our researchers at the time, a man named Jason Tito, was upstairs in the upper floors of the theater, I guess you would call it the balcony, and kind of taking a picture down towards the main floor. Now, there was nobody there. If the picture's clearly on the website. You can see there's nobody anywhere nearby. You can see a green beam on one side of the shot. And in the far corner of the building, on the wall, you see kind of a weird-shaped shadow figure that shows up there, a black shadow. And it has a very strange kind of elongated head, which is kind of indicative of some of the images I've seen in the past of shadow images. One of my members is a woman named Rosemary Ellen Guiley. I don't know if you're familiar with that name, but yep. She's an author of about 60 books.
I just had her
she's
on.
A constant guest on George Norrie's yep. Coast to Coast AM.
We just had her on about a week ago or so.
Great.
Yep.
And we actually have worked with her on many different occasions, and she's always stops in on when we do the Lincoln Theater's investigations. And when I showed that picture to her, the first thing that she saw was the, kind of the head, which is very kind of stretched out, kind of elongated. And I asked her about that. I said, well, what do you think that you think that's a true shadow image is? Or you think it possibly maybe just somebody's shadow, or there's really nothing for it to, if you see the picture, there's really nothing for the flash to have cast a shadow that far there, and surely it was nobody by. And her first comment was that's how a lot of these shadow figures show up. They're misshapen heads. That's kind of their MO. So when you get something like that, it kind of, in my opinion, and at least Rosemary Ellen Guiley's opinion, it kind of rules out the possibility that it's a real person's shadow. Because, again, unless you're moving, and if you were moving, the entire thing would be misshapen, not just the head. So it could be a moving shadow that maybe was captured. But then the whole body would be kind of elongated because the shadow would be moving at the time. So that was kind of interesting that we had gotten that. And that was one of the best pieces of physical evidence that we got as far as a picture that was taken there. And there had been reports, as I mentioned, of many shadow images that were actually seen within the theater.
When you go into an investigation like this, Dale, as an investigator, and it's kind of, I'm just curious, it gets down to the core of your interest, and I'm sure it's kind of the same outlook on most locations that you go into, but what is that outlook? What is your goal when you go into and investigate a haunted location? What are you hoping to have happen? What is, at the end of the day, what's the best case scenario there for you?
Well, I should maybe back up a little bit and say why I got involved in the first place.
Sure.
The reason I got involved in ghost research in the first place, and I don't like to call it ghost hunting because it indicates that you're with a gun and you're actually hunting ghosts.
Sure.
So I like to call it ghost research. But it was my idea to prove the existence of life after death. And if I figured that I could prove and come up with conclusive, undeniable proof, either through audio, video, pictures, personal encounters, equipment fluctuations, that there was something that survives death, such as a ghost or a spirit, then that would prove the existence of life after death. So when we get involved in cases, what we're looking for, obviously, is we're looking for the best case scenario is to come away with evidence. Obviously, visual evidence is the best. Pictures, video was even better. And we have some really dynamite video clips on our website that we've gotten of shadow figures moving around and just actual full-bodied apparitions. But EVPs are great. Disembodied voices are great. Some things that you can actually hear in real time is the best. So when you hear something, you ask a question, you get a response, and you hear it with your own ears at the same time, a disembodied voice, that's amazing. Or you see something in real time, that's amazing. It's always nice to get something later as you're reviewing your evidence, that you pick up a shadow, you pick up an EVP, something of that nature. So when we go in with the idea that we're hoping to document, verify, and confirm sightings that have happened in the past by people, the proprietors of the locations that we're going to, the people that maybe, if there's a like a place that they do paranormal tours for the public, maybe the guides that have walked through, the people that they're doing on a daily basis, they're in there almost every day, day in and day out. They would be the people that would have the most experiences, and to document some of those with hard physical proof has always been our goal.
Sure. Do you believe that over the course of your research that you have found that proof of life after death?
Well, I have found things that are undeniable, that pictures, personal encounters. I've actually been touched several times. I mean, I've been involved in ghost research for about 44 years now, the better portion of my lifetime. I've investigated about 4,100 cases during that time. So it's not like some of these reality TV shows that each week they go out and they get touched, they get slime, they get pushed down, they get scratched. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can count maybe on two hands, the 10 times or less, the amount of times that I've actually been physically interacted with a spirit.
Sure.
And I think, touching of the face, brushing of the hair, being poked in the back. I actually had my left buttocks grabbed by something one time in Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, which was very, very unusual. So I've had interactions. I've actually seen some excellent videos that we've captured in the past. We've gotten direct, intelligent responses from spirits using devices such as the obelisk, the ghost boxes, the phasma box, the mini portal, things of that nature. And even these newer devices like the SLS camera, the structured light sensor camera, which is the Kinect system, which basically it projects a series of infrared dots. And if something comes into that mapped out area, it'll actually show up as a stick figure. We've actually had stick figures interact with us. So I think I have evidence. I don't know if it's evidence that, everybody would agree upon, that's true evidence, because there are always skeptics out there that, and I welcome skeptics. I welcome people that try to debunk stuff, because we often look for natural explanations ourselves. There have been many times that we've actually captured something, seen it, we're able to see it on the monitors, and they go, "Oh, what was that?" And then we, maybe we'll stop recording, and then we'll go and we'll try to replicate that to see, okay, how could that have happened? Was it a stray light source? Was it a shadow coming from some other room? Did we walk in front of an IR beam or something? And in many cases, we were not able to debunk it. One case in particular down in the Thomas House in Red Boiling Springs, Tennessee, there was a weird kind of a shimmery effect that appeared twice within about a minute and a half clip on a static IR camera down in the lobby. This is the same lobby where people had seen the shadow figure and coming from the doorway going to the front desk and disappearing. And we tried every possible way, including having cars go past, and illuminating the figure, flashlights, glare, flash pictures. We could not replicate this. So I to this day, we don't know what we captured. In many cases, when we try replications, and we always try to debunk what we have just picked up. If we capture it at the same time, that's the neat thing about digital cameras nowadays, is you get that instant picture.
Sure.
When I was first investigating, when I started out, I was using a 35mm. So I didn't know until I had the film developed if I captured anything. Now, today, you get that instant picture, you get the instant gratification that you may have captured something, and then immediately you can try to replicate that. Oh, I got something. Here it shows up on the screen. Let's try some other experiments. Let's try some other cameras. Let's try 35 millimeters even. Let's try digital. Let's try infrared. Let's try full spectrum and see if a picture shows up again.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Dale Kaczmarek about the Haunted Lincoln Theater and his tactics and discussion on ghost hunting. In part two of our interview, we'll discuss EVPs caught on raw tape versus caught with digital recorders, or EVPs that are derived through a spirit box of some sort. Which ones hold more weight? Also, what drew Dale into ghost research to begin with? What's the darkest case that Dale has ever been involved with? Does he believe that he's found proof of life after death? And what is the line that Dale won't cross when it comes to investigating a dark location? And why do theaters tend to be some of the most haunted places? Those questions and more in part two of our interview. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. For only $5 a month, you'll have access to part two of this episode and all of our episodes, including access to our episodes months before they are released to the public. If you're looking for more episodes to binge on, that's the way to do it. Patreon.com/thegravetalks. Help keep us on the air and enjoy more episodes and bonus part twos. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.